It's a brand new best podcast in baseball, and it's time to check in with Professor Jeff Gordon because he's got our midterm grades of the Cardinals, their pitching staff, their players on the field, and of course, the front office and the coaching manager in the dugout. So let's talk to Professor Gordon in his return to the best podcast in baseball. Oh, and first up, trade deadline. Cue the music. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Closet by Design of St. Louis. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, joined this week again by my colleague, columnist, instant offense, tip sheet author, and every year for every professional sport here at the Post-Dispatch, professor offering up his grades. It's Jeff Gordon. Gordo, how are you? How are the term papers this year?
Well, it was, a mix of good and bad, but a lot of guys made progress. The expectations in general were exceeded for the team. And there were some guys who faded, some difficulties with a few of the higher paid guys. And of course, when you look at the whole organization, while this plan was probably the right one to get younger, the execution and messaging created quite a business impact. And we can talk about that down the road too.
Absolutely. Yeah, let's start where so much of the conversation has been on social media, around the Cardinals, and, you know, just absolutely everywhere. Did you dig the end of the All-Star game?
Well, it was different. You would like it. It'd be great if the guys would stick around who are the you'd want to see out there. No offense to the polar bear. We want to see him out there. But it'd be great if Shohei had stuck around and he'd see all the top guys. But, no, it's – let's hope we don't go skills competition in baseball like we did in hockey. Where you
so just you wanted to see Shohei Ohtani instead of Stowers from Miami?
Yeah. I mean, no offense, but because it was, you know, it was fascinating. Of course, Schwarber's born for that.
Schwarber is born for that. Yeah, he was.
So that was fun, and you know, but do we want to see a skills competition resolving games as they do in hockey? I don't know, man.
Yeah, it's a weird thing when all of a sudden you have a sport whose the greatness of the All-Star game to me is that you can't not play the game of baseball at full speed, right? Like the defense controls the ball and ignites execution. And so you're not going to have a pitcher go up there and go, well, it's the All-Star game. Here is an underhand soft toss. You know, I mean, you might not see diving from infielders and stuff. So you might not see the full speed game, but it's the one sport where like you can really, to borrow a phrase from the kids, are you ready for how hip I can talk? You can really nerf the other sports in their pro games, in their all-star games, right? You know, basketball, football, even soccer to a certain extent. You can all nerf those games. Baseball, you really can't until you change it completely and play a different game. They're at the side. Atlanta, kudos to Atlanta. From the start of that day, particularly a couple hours before the game, all the way through that wild ending, what a job Atlanta did. They did a really good job, Major League Baseball and Atlanta. They did a really good job hosting that game. The Hank Aaron tribute on July 15th for 7:15 was incredible. It was, Jeff, it was chill inducing. And you know, Pete Alonso, who was booed every time he showed up, hits that 3-run homer to put the National League ahead or further ahead early, and they cheered him. I mean, it was a really well done All-Star game, very compelling baseball too. And I think in a lot of ways he's a great player, he's a great hitter, real legit power hitter, and also like got a lot of, you know, personality, and he's funny. Brent Rooker, you know, if he got a bigger stage, that would not be a bad thing for baseball. If Brent Rooker wasn't only a secret in Sacramento or wherever the A's are playing. Kudos to them. But they could have done a better job of explaining, you know, how that ended, that three swings to determine, you know, who wins the game. It's not a new rule. It's just, this is the first time that the game ever finished tie for the rule to be used. There's they could learn from that. And one idea that my my friend and baseball writing colleague Gordon Wittenmeyer mentioned was like, maybe have the managers announce before the game who their three are. Like, how compelling would that be? And then they had to explain it. You could get a good news story. You could get a good debate there. You know, and that might, and even if it never happens, at least then it's on the record as to like who they were going to pick. That would be interesting.
Now, it would have been the explanation, and also conceding that tradition has superstars getting out of there ASAP to get into their break. So Aaron Judge does his post gamer in a or mid gamer in his street clothes and in books. So I mean,
that's not.
I think it's okay for the All-Star game. I'd hate to see it happen in a regular in a real game.
No, gosh, no.
Which is my
don't even put that in the universe, Jeff Gordon. Take that back.
Yeah, well, you know, you give these people like, that was interesting. Maybe we could do that. Okay, never mind.
No,
and I'm okay with the.
All of a sudden, the highest paid coach on the staff would be the guy who throws the best BP, because they would all have agents.
Right.
They'd be like, man, I throw a very firm, deliberate BP over the middle. You're going to want me for those. No, we're not doing this. Nope.
Yeah, then the analytics people would have to weigh in on who that pitcher would be, just like the analytics people and the video coaches work on shootouts in hockey. But that's another issue as far as that goes. And the other thing I wanted to ask you was the Aaron tribute was just spectacular on television. Yeah. But I just wondered quickly from you being there in person, what was that like?
It was incredible. You know, we had been told, or I talked to somebody who was at least familiar with it beforehand, and they were like urging me not to miss it. And it was even better than advertised. The obviously the technology and the ability to kind of project all that on the field was spectacular. It looked great. The moment the firework went off, I don't know what that was like on TV, but that was a gasp moment in at the ballpark. I mean, you just like it was like a great movie, right? When there's like a great action movie or even like a, you know, just like a great theatrical experience when there's a plot twist that is revealed on the screen and the audience goes that moment of silence before the cheers break out just because of the surprise of it. Either, you know, I'll give you a superhero example when Captain America catches Thor's hammer in the Avengers movie. Like that moment where it's silent as everybody goes, what did we just watch? Oh my gosh, that's so incredible. And then the roar. And that's what that firework was like. It goes off and you know, like, oh my gosh, I'm watching. They recreated the comet of 7:15. Putting the players at the positions was really cool. I don't know how that looked on TV. Obviously, it was flat. You could see that it didn't have dimension to it because obviously they weren't there. I mean, they're not dealing with holograms and stuff, but it looked so cool, man. It looked so cool. And the Atlanta Braves shared this photo of Billy Aaron, Hank Aaron's widow, watching that was, I mean, it's just, it gives you all the emotions. You know, it's just, it was so well done. It's a great tribute. You know, it's something that they need to think about how to do. You know, hockey's been doing it because they have the sheet of ice as a canvas. They've been doing similar things for a long time. They'll do their hype videos, as you know, on their ice, and they can make it, you know, movie quality just because the canvas is there. To turn the baseball field into that canvas was, I mean, it was really, really moving, and I'm eager to see what the next evolution of that is. You know, there's not a Hank Aaron to celebrate the happy coincidence of July 15th being the game and 7:15 being the homer is part of it. You know, we have the sesquicentennial next year in Philadelphia. So will it be turned into a patriotic gala broadcast on the field? I'm not sure. Wrigley Field is on the horizon. So can they do something like that at Wrigley Field for the greats of the Cubs, or even the grade of that ballpark? What do they do? I'm really eager to see where this goes next. But you could definitely see, man, just think of a moment like if the All-Star game, Jeff, comes back to St. Louis, where you could project the Cardinal greats on the field as if they were together and it would cross generations. You could have Bob Gibson with, you know, Jim Edmonds in center. You could have Stan Musial backing up Albert Pujols, you know, or, you know, I mean, just any number of things that you could do. You could have Yadier Molina catching a ball from, you know, from Stan Musial from right field, Roger Maris on the relay to tag a runner out. I mean, you could do such incredible things with this technology, all on the field. I'm really eager to see where it goes.
Well, and I think that they were so well planned for it. The overhead visuals, how they did it on television for that whole scene, and it played well for that.
Yeah.
You know, the dimension was fine because of the way they shot it. So, yeah, great made for TV event. Obviously, great for the fans there, and a high bar. You know, I'd hate to be the guys organizing future All-Star games, right? Like, oh boy, they set a pretty high bar to beat. So good on them.
Next year's going to be big. Next year, they've been planning for years. You may recall, fans, listeners may recall, that they announced that 2026 was going to be in Philadelphia way early, far earlier than they had. They hadn't announced these three previous years when they announced Philly, all in preparation for all of the major kind of All-Star games being in Philly as part of the big 1776 celebration planned in that city. So we'll see.
Well, we're looking forward to it, and let's just hope that the other topic that sort of cropped up this week, and some guys commented on it, that's what's going to happen after next season, but we don't want to bum out people and dwell on that too much. But
we have all winter to talk about the forthcoming.
Well, it was interesting. The players are prepared, so buckle up.
Absolutely. All right, Jeff, let's just get right to it then. I promised folks we'd talk about the trade deadline before getting to your grades. So let's do it. Are you a buyer or are you a seller if you're the Cardinals? Let's get in the big chair. Jeff Gordon takes over as interim president of baseball operations. Are you buying or are you selling, or are you sitting there right now going, well, I got some time on the clock yet to decide?
Yeah, it's a great question. I talked about this with Lynn Worthy on our inside pitch video, and he pointed out that if you do sell, you know, your relievers, you know, you sell Helsley, you sell Maton, you know, you just, your season's over and it's going to be bad finishing up the year. And so you wonder if, and then the younger guys who are enjoying playing meaningful games and are developing as such and are becoming a good unit, cohesive team, playing the right way, you lose a lot of benefit from that. And you got to weigh that versus whatever return you could get in a trade. And, you know, talking to Lynn, he says, you know, can you get a return that's worth it to sacrifice the end of the season? And, you know, also the fans have already been impacted this year by the team's lack of commitment to winning, although the team has been winning enough to stay in the chase. So there's some potential additional damage there if you go into a full flat-out collapse at the end of the year because you've traded too much. So
yeah,
I'm a big believer, and there's a benefit to trying to compete. So I would have to really be compelled on a fire sale that it was worth it. Now, the question coming back to you are there baseball trades that could be made that could help the team beyond this year that would reduce some redundancies or that would remove somebody who could be replaced and still get something? So, in other words, play it halfway, either, which is kind of where this team is right now. Is there a halfway play that would maybe help the team a little bit, help the team next year, not gut the team, but not really change the course of what they're doing? Is there a way to do that? And I guess we'll find out.
Not just now. It's just like Ben. I hope it's not like an oversimplification, but it sure seems like that's just where the Cardinals have existed for a while. I'm not, you know, they just are in that nebulous zone between, and this goes back 10 years. You know, I remember Baseball Prospectus asked me, Jeff, to write the essay for their annual book that they put out to preview the season. And I wrote the story, and I've been really wanting to do it, and I'd reported on it. I looked into it, did some research, and this was the chance to do it kind of like in an essay format as opposed to an article or a news story kind of format, was to look at how the Cardinals got in the worst possible place, stuck in the middle, where they either weren't going to go all in, because the criticism of them a lot was they didn't take that next step, as in 2019. You know, you have Paul Goldschmidt, now go make a play for, is it Bryce Harper? Is it a ace pitcher? Okay, no. A few years later, trade for Nolan Arenado. Okay, now you got Arenado and you got Goldschmidt. Why aren't you adding on the starter to then kind of complete the Trinity to lead you into October. You know, but then they also weren't all out. I guess in 2023, they kind of had their hand forced and they did that. But even those deals were really about what Mosaic would call arbitrage, right? Turning what you have into what you're missing, not into what will, you know, what will lift you. And they were missing pitching depth. And so they made it a priority to just acquire en masse pitchers. And they got a Tekoa Roby in that deal, which is good. And they got a John King in that deal, and he's been helpful. And they got Thomas DeJacy in that deal, and he's a strong player who's struggling right now, but he's in an odd role in the majors. And, you know, so they did get return on it, but their purpose, Jeff, was to, you know, kind of recreate and build depth. So even then it was like stuck in the middle. I think this is setting up for another kind of thing like you described, where they try to have it both ways. And the one wild card in it all is John Mozeliak and his last year. And where, you know, he's obviously very data-driven. He's very pragmatic. He's very business-oriented. He's talked about that. You know, the Cardinals acknowledge that they're pretty conservative and can be risk-averse. They don't want to look at the division elsewhere and see a star that they knew was coming playing for another team. They have gotten a little shy after the Rosarena, Adolis Garcia, all those deals, especially, you know, the Marcelo Zuna deal. And so I wonder, you know, if there was ever a time for them to have this like unexpected factor, this outlier to factor into the equation, it's that it's Mozeliak's last trade deadline. And you want to go out with a show. Maybe the show is that baseball deal that you're talking about. Move one of your young talents who you feel you have enough information on right now, or that you're willing to stomach him becoming a star elsewhere for the starter that you don't have on the horizon and can help you next year.
Yeah, and I'm a pessimist on that front. I think a team would be stupid to trade a pitcher that's got term left for – pretty much any of these guys.
Interesting. You know,
because I think they have some really good young players, but is there a star? I mean, you don't want to trade Burleson. He's a good hitter, and he's mm-hmm. he's a ball player. Donovan's a super utility guy, has value for sure, and can hit. But, you know, I don't know that where the risk is or what the reward is, frankly, for a team to trade a great pitcher here for one of these guys. So I don't know. I grade these guys, and I appreciated their progress and gave some guys some really good grades. But I don't know that trade is there as far as somebody who's really going to make a difference. I mean, you can get somebody who's going to be on your team next year pitching, but is that going to be somebody who's elevated? Is he going to even approach what Sonny Gray's been able to do? Better than Pallante, better than Liberatore, those guys are for sure. You could probably find somebody who's more proven. Those guys have tried to find their way. Better than Michaelis, better than Fetty. Let's hope so, because those guys got poor grades. We'll talk about that. But obviously, they've been disastrous, really, here of late, broadly speaking. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I think there's a baseball trade there. I don't know if it's transformational. And I look at this team, Derek, as they're not going to ever go full tank because they came close enough to it and saw what the reaction was with the fans. I don't think they'll travel that road again, nor will they ever spend gigantic money on any individual player in today's world when we're talking what the Kyle Tuckers of the world are going to get. So are they always going to be trying to operate in that squishy middle with the hope that it comes together one year where it clicks? Because I think they're done going after older guys. I think they're going to turn the page on trying that gambit.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I think they already started, and I think – you know, I don't think you're going to see much from that. We have a lot to learn about how Heim Bloom will operate, because you can't take entirely, or you shouldn't. Maybe it will end up this way. Maybe you take entirely with Tampa, what he did in Tampa Bay, and that's just who the Cardinals are going to be. But they shouldn't. Fans shouldn't expect them to be that way. They have more support. They have more revenue. They have more, and more history, more everything than Tampa Bay. So why operate like Tampa Bay? Be innovative. Be all the things that Tampa Bay has to be, but then lacquer on some money and spending on top of it you know, just to live up to the brand. So I don't, if the Cardinals go all Tampa Bay, then that's a whole other discussion. But I think what we'll learn is how Heim Bloom is going to kind of blend the two worlds that he comes from with the Tampa Bay innovator and Boston big budget, though some of the decisions he had to make there were clearly on a budget being reduced. We'll see how he blends those things. And I don't think we know entirely, like, where does a closer fit into his spending? You know, what does he look like there? You know, a starter who's out there, Jeff, is, and it would be a reunion, would be Sandy Alcantara, right? He's signed through this year, but there's a whopper of an option on him. $21 million for next year. Be in his early 30s, 31. You know, is that the guy who, you know, he obviously was, he became the centerpiece, and actually kind of was, he was the centerpiece of Mozeliak's deal that he's talked about, was the one that was the most difficult, and looking back on, was maybe the one he'd undo. Do you look at, do you like that? Do you like him coming back? It would be a little bit of a classic move, right? It would give the Cardinals the potential of having three $20 million pitchers next year. I don't know how much Heim Bloom has an appetite for that. Again, we're learning. But it would also give someone who pairs just ahead of Sonny Gray, and it would unwind the clock a bit while also being a retro move to see if, like, hey, get him for a year, see if you extend him, because you're not getting that guy on the free agent market.
Now, but the question is, Derek Gould, can you fix him? Now, he's shown signs of getting on the right track, but the aggregate numbers are not good. He's tried to come back, and he's tried to rediscover what made him, you know, the best pitcher, the workhorse, the throwback for a significant bit of time. So the investment would be, do you believe in your people fixing him? Because, that would be a guy you could get for some of what we're talking about here in terms of redundancy, left-hand bats and such, no question. But can he be that guy? Right. Can you fix
him? And, well, I mean, the two ways to look at that, right? How much would getting out of Miami help, right? So you'd have a better defensive team or better team around him. That helps players. And also, like, how having him when he's a full year removed from his return, and the data shows that that's when, you know, starters tend to pick it up, right? And that would be next year. Again, high dollar figure there, right? But, you know, do you bank on that being the trend, right? Where a starter is a full year, 12, 14, even more months removed from his return, not just the surgery, but from his return, that then he picks up. I mean, there's some indication, you know, over this recent stretch, while the numbers aren't great, you know, you look at, he's allowed, you know, 18 runs in his last three starts, did have a strong kind of run there for a little bit, but there's some, like, metrics and like encouraging signs as far as his health and strength picking up. So does that all culminate in him being even better next year? That's what you as an acquiring team would be betting on.
You know, and let's face it, Heim Bloom's got a good touch for finding those types of moves, betting on the improvement. And we're a team that's hopeful of winning the World Series next year would view that somewhat differently. They may at some point view that as a depth option, but not a primary move, because they need more sure. Teams in that mode are going to be looking for more sure answers to their pitching. For the Cardinals, that would be a bet worth taking, because while they're hoping to continue on an upward scale, they're realistically, you know, this is not a team that is looking for a game two World Series starter, because that would be quite the journey from here to there.
Yeah.
I mean, I hate to say a Cardinal fan, but yeah, you may be a better candidate for that type of a turnaround project than, let's say, the Dodgers.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting.
Except the Dodgers would take 12 of those turnaround candidates and just hope that one of them works, and then pay the rest of them to go away.
Yeah, how about that? The Dodgers, what do you make of the Dodgers taking a Missouri quarterback?
Well, again, they can just put him in the freezer for a year and see how it happens. They don't have to tell the kid he can't play quarterback. They can just sit on him. He only threw 15 innings this year. They can make the long-term play on that. There are no limits to LA. They can just do whatever and aim high with stuff, take chances. It doesn't matter, because whatever they need, they go get.
Yeah, no kidding. What a fascinating like play that'll be for them, just to see how it goes and how much they like him or want to woo him or want to make it worth his while just to consider them. I'm eager to see how that goes. All right, so we've solved everything. Cardinals are neither sellers or buyers. We're in for it. I don't know if it'll be. It's a hard time to. It could be a really compelling, if not exciting, trade deadline. And, you know, fans and media and everybody who asked me asked how much Chaim Bloom will be influencing this. I mean, look, all parties have described a collaborative effort through the course of this year with a real clear understanding as to who is in charge. And at the end of the day, that's really ownership, but it's John Mozeliak acting on behalf of ownership and in his role of president of baseball operations. And he has said that a motivation for him is putting Chaim in the best spot to start with a roster that he can shape. So any move that influences the future, he's getting input from Chaim on. And, you know, does that mean that you'll see a deal that is entirely Chaim produced, Chaim influenced, all that stuff? No. But does that mean that everything that the Cardinals do that has any sort of influence on the future team and the look of the 2026 team, Bloom will be involved in that. I mean, that they've been pretty clear on that, and we'll have a way to shape that and have an opinion on that. And, you know, that I think we've seen, and maybe there's a better way to convey it. I tried, but it's just not, you know, I guess it doesn't really fit on Twitter, but we have seen a very collaborative kind of effort here over this year, even though you haven't heard much from Chaim. You have seen Rob Serfolio out very prominent, and he's not only involved in player development, which is part of his charge, but also the performance, which is part of his charge, and what that means from just the interaction, because he's been with the major league team. And he sees it as a global thing, and he's having input there. So you do see this collaborative effort from both sides of the current era with the front office.
Yeah, I think a good test of that will be, we'll talk about him some more. But Jordan Walker, you're trying to – the collaborative effort that it takes to try to get him back on track, and right now trying to rely on your player development side to assist with that. I love – listening to him discuss, you know, the performance plans, improvement plans, tailoring everything for each individual, using all disciplines, you know, analytics, the biometrics, everything, video, all that stuff. And it's going to be interesting to see as the world comes together to try to get Jordan Walker back on track. It requires that everybody's on the same page organizationally, from your big league field staff all the way down through all of your folks in the minors to your coordinators to, you know, all the executives. Like, how do you do this? This is like whenever this happens with a player, you know, how do you do this? How do you manage Weatherholt's rise and his implementation? How do you fix a guy or try to fix a guy who's struggling? What about the guys who are on the bubble, who are trying to get there, who are close, who are trying to finish their process in the minors? How do you handle Arobi, his development, keeping him healthy, just deciding whether he gets a look in the bigs sooner than later or whether you just have to continue to be super careful? I mean, it's going to be fascinating to see how it works. And hopefully we get to the end of the year and there's not going to be the sort of massive disconnect between the field staff and the rest of the organization that last year.
Yeah, well, that's a great point. Yeah, I don't know about that. And I think you make an excellent point about kind of the tone that they set, right? If they pull the plug on this team, then what kind of culture are they really developing these young players in? And also then exactly what you said, what are they sending a message to the coaching staff about, hey, thanks for putting all this work in. Thanks for exceeding expectations, really, whether they did for fans or not, but they certainly did for the front office. Thanks for doing all that. And then, hey, we're going to take away all your players that you did that with. You know, so I think that's a real clear point. All right, let's get to your grades. Where do you want to start, Jeff? You can reveal your grades to me.
Well, we'll start with we'll start backward and go, we'll start at the top and go down. You know, looking at a favorite topic for everybody was, you know, I always look at ownership, look at management, and then I look at the field staff. So The field staff I gave an A to because the team exceeded expectations, and the field staff has implemented a lot of instruction at the big league level. And I know Ollie's been promoting that and making a point of promoting that, but it is worth promoting. It's worth him saying that because it's true. I think that most of the guys they wanted to move forward are moving forward, and they're doing it in a way that is beneficial for the long term, at the same time keeping the team competitive. And at times those two goals don't align, and they've had to kind of play it by ear in some cases, trying to give more trial and error than he might normally have. But it's paid off, and I give full marks to that group for, this is what you're given, this is your mandate, and I think they've followed through. You know, with management, it's tricky because that's more of a, so I give those guys an A. The management's sort of like, okay, it's a middle scenario because, first of all, Mosaic's basically handcuffed. This is your team. We've cut your budget. Here's your mandate. Play the young guys. You know, they've made some waiver claims. They've made some minor moves along the edges. But to this point, he's just been status quo, watching what's happening. His grade will be postseason grade. Will be the one that matters. However, I did give management a B because I thought the draft went well, and I think that you're seeing the and I have some belief in the implementation of what's happened with the farm system, the work that's been done. It's not visible on the field so much, but I think there's been real work done. I've seen real progress with a lot of the key prospects in the minors. Most of them have progressed. So I think if you're looking at what's happened in the minors, what happened with the draft, what's Randy done, what's the new farm director, what everybody's done, what's Bloom's influence, I think there's a lot of positives. As far as Mo goes, everybody wants to give him an F. Well, he just is just kind of sitting there waiting to have his influence now that all of this has played out leading up to the trade deadline. So he's a lame duck, and that kind of brings me to the ownership. I've given – I think last year the final grade was an F because it's just 2 years of, it just didn't work. And then this decision to do what it did starting into this season, I think was an understandable decision. And and they had to get caught up on spending money in the farm system and such, which they did. I think they made a good choice to pick Heim Bloom. I think they made a poor choice to go lame duck, and they did a horrendous choice with the messaging. But it's not, I can't give them an F because I think they made the right decision to move the franchise this way. Spending more money would have been smarter. Having, maybe moving on from Mo, make him a consultant, just put Bloom in charge, let him message, would have been smarter. But I can't fault the direction that they took because this team relied on older guys for too long, and it finally went bad on them, and they had to change course, and they were stuck with some contracts, and they had to move on, and that from previous decisions, there had to be a change of course. So I give them good marks for change of course, terrible marks for execution. And the bottom line is half the stadium's half empty. They've caused damage to the business. They've created a challenge for themselves to regain that business. So, no, that it's not a thing to celebrate, but I didn't view it as a complete failure.
I was watching this clip of, some of the – I can't remember the exact play, but it was some of Jim Edmonds' big catches, and one of them obviously is in Cincinnati, but there was another one in St. Louis that I happened upon, and it was like, oh my gosh, look how packed the stadium is. And it just was like a regular game. It just was any old game, night game, but it seems like it seems like you just wonder if that's gonna happen again, or if that was just kind of peak Cardinals, if that was the era right there, that everything kind of coalesced, and things happen in cycles. So you had the Gas House Gang, and then a generation later you had Bob Gibson in that group, and then a generation later you had Ozzie Smith in that group, and then a generation later you have Jim Edmonds and Albert Pujols and Scott Rolen, and now you're waiting, does a generation later bring all that back? We'll see. I don't know. And there's more to it than just the baseball. There's obviously the economy. What's the phrase, Jeff? The economy stupid? Is that the phrase? There's the economy and the entertainment dollar. There's a lot of competition for it, and there's a lot less of it for people to spend. And, you know, so sports are part of that, as we saw at the All-Star game. Entertainment is part of it. And so are the Cardinals, an entertaining place to go see a ball game. I think they're wrestling with that. And that's to your point, you know, that's going to be the real challenge. Not just of, I mean, look, that's going to be the real challenge of the new leadership. We're entering an era of new leadership for the Cardinals, not only on the baseball operations side, but also you're seeing Bill DeWitt III very prominent on the business side. You know, there's a new kind of direction and new voices in ballpark experience. They're looking for a new way, new thoughtful way, new ideas for the ballpark. So, you know, the we focus a lot, as rightfully so, on the kind of this era of transition for baseball operations. But we should also acknowledge that is also happening on the business and ballpark side too. You see examples of it, and you see hires that reflect that, and you see the growing decibel level and influence with the Cardinals, and also his presence at a major league level of Bill DeWitt III.
Yeah. And also let's look at the, I hope, significant renovations to the stadium, because right now in this environment where it's always been hot and humid in St. Louis, but the weather between the rain and
the heat
has been even more of both. And this ballpark does not react well to that. So, yeah, a lot of work to do. And they've left themselves.
I don't think a roof's coming, Jeff. I don't think a roof.
No, I brought that up. And they said, no, they don't believe a roof's going to be in the deal. So
I don't think a roof is coming.
No, but it's and then, of course, St. Louis itself, downtown, is still going to have to continue to its evolution. People hope for further future investment to bring some life back to it, but there's been quite a bit of regression.
It won't be instantaneous. Yeah.
No. So there's a lot to do there. And the days of the 35,000 on a Tuesday night are long gone for a routine game. And when you're seeing weekend games against good opponents, not drawing that sort of crowd, well, that's concerning. All right. So I'll move on to the,
Let's move on
to the pitching. Obviously, there's only one above average starting pitcher, Sonny Gray. You know, I look at Andre Pallante and Matthew Liberatore. They made some strides this year for sure, but it's been Andre's still trying to figure it out, come up with pitches, literally experimenting on the fly. And Matthew's learning to deal with the grind of being a starter for the full season, some good, some bad. Both guys have had good stretches. Both guys have had tough stretches. Andre, without any swing and miss, is a tough candidate to stay in the rotation, and the reverse split still being an issue. So they're in the middle of the pack. What can you do with Eric Fetty and Miles Michaelis? I mean, these guys, Miles has been what he's been, and that's poor, below average, and same Eric became that. Earlier this year, Eric was fine. Eric has taken the wrong direction. And it may be slightly less terrible as last outing, but those two guys have been problematic. And to go back to giving Ollie credit for the success, when you only have one above average starting pitcher, and Sonny even can't quite say that he's an ace because he doesn't take much pressure off your bullpen, with a few exceptions this year. He hasn't really worked deep into games. He's pitched well when he's pitched and for as long as he's pitched. But and he is a strikeout versus walks. His ratios are incredible. But having said that, you know, this rotation is impressive. Now, it stayed healthy. That's the good news. It's just that, you know, 40% of the rotation is below average or thereabouts. So that was my concern. Now, bullpen, that was a real strength of the group, obviously. You look at, Maton he's had a couple rough outings, but pretty remarkable what they've gotten from him.
Yeah.
He's at the top end. JoJo was terrible early, but got the juice back in his arm, and certainly he's been lights out in his role. Helsley, you know, more hittable for sure. He's a B and not an A, but, he's got the saves. He's got some wins, just more hittable. The numbers are pretty stark in terms of, you know, batting average, balls in play.
Yeah.
All those things. So there's – the top part of that bullpen has been good. Riley O'Brien here recently coming back has shown some signs of being really good. Matt Swanson has shown some signs after he's had some bad outings, but he's also shown some promise. It's just kind of a mixed bag beyond your late inning guys. Some of the younger guys have shown some things. Canelo showed signs that he could maybe be something in limited duty. The one guy that took a bump in this thing because he hasn't had a chance to rebuild his stock, Ryan Fernandez, was pretty bad early, and he's been better in Memphis, but he hasn't really had a chance to come back up and prove that he's a different pitcher than the one we saw earlier. And he was so important last year. So if there was one failure in the whole pitching staff, he was a key guy last year, and he utterly just couldn't get it done this year. Your two veteran starters you were hoping more from didn't. And so it was kind of a mixed bag. And, and the question becomes, if you lose that reliability at the end of the bullpen, then what becomes of your team?
To continue the academic kind of analogy here of handing out grades, I wondered if you would do the bullpen as if it was a group project. You know, the Graceffo, Roy Croft, Swanson, Riley O'Brien. I mean, none of them really spent the whole semester, if you will, with the Cardinals. So they had more of like an aggregate group project that they had to show at the end. Like, how would you look at just as them as a group that they did? Like, if you just were to
The Memphis Shuttle. Just call it the Memphis Shuttle.
Yeah.
You know, it's tough because, like, Graceffo's had some really effective outings, and he's had a couple terrible ones that really effed up his numbers. It was really bad.
That is an amazing pun, Professor Gordon.
Yeah,
you just that's dropped on us.
And that would have been
because the F there is for fail, right?
Oh yeah, freakishly bad. So too, it's just bad. And then you see that he's got the ability as well. So he's better. He's got wins. He's got a long distance save. But he's got a 6 ERA because a couple of those outings were just got awful.
Yeah.
So it's tough. I think I would give the Memphis Shuttle a B on balance if I'm going to throw O'Brien in there, because coming back from his injury early on wasn't as good. More recently, very good. And, you know, there are some pieces there. Roy Croft has had a tough time in Memphis, had a tough time here. So dropping the arm angle and such, he needs more work.
All right, real quick, who got the higher grade for you? If you like, if you want to put it on like the 0 to 100 scale, who got the higher grade, Mats or Maton?
Maton, just because Mats was good. I mean, for sure, and you know, he had those two, he had to fill in early, start off a couple games, and with 26 relief appearances, very good. But I just think Maton had such a run of success and in high leverage spots where Mats was just extremely useful because he could come in and pop in, and they were pretty darn close, but I made slightly higher with Maton, but the two very good examples of success stories this year. I think Mats really helped himself, obviously stronger against lefties, not as well good against righties. That may have limited his value as a starter, but I think he really found his spot, and it would have great value for a team. If you're looking for him as a matchup guy and you're a contender and you want a guy who's pretty, you can use a lot and be versatile early or late, there's a guy I'd go for. You know, strikeouts to walks, very good.
There are two teams in New York that I really, well, I know at least one of them, you know, is like, all right, where would he fit? He knows the area. He's from the area. He's pitched for the Mets. You know, is that a guy who kind of has had a reinvention in that relief role and has all the other elements that come with having experienced life as a starter there in New York, and what kind of fit could he be there? I think it's really interesting. I don't, you know, Matthew Liberatore, what he's done this year in the role is very impressive, but I'd have a hard time if you had a most improved award, not giving it to Mats.
You know, right. He's been just right there, and he's been so reliable. There's been a lot of fluctuation with most of these pitchers. That's made it very tricky. And I give Matthew full credit for his maturity and his approach to this. But, you know, with him, it's just like his mechanics start to fray. And because he's trying to go the distance of a long season as a starter, and there are times when he gets out of sync and then things go haywire. But his approach and how he's gone about his business and how he's matured, they're all very impressive. And I think, in a way, maybe giving him a C is a little tough, but again, some of these outings, some of the fraying, he's still got to prove he can get through the campaign. I expect him to be a very solid above average starter by next year.
Interesting. All right. Position players.
Right. So you look at the guys who Ivan Herrera, in between injuries, just a dynamic job offensively. And I don't really mark him down for his inability to catch because his bat plays so well There are other things you can do with him. And it's, you know, a little bit of a hedge on him there, but because he needs work as a catcher. But his hitting was so good. They're so desperate for right side hitting. He's been able to hit in big situations, really big there. Alec Burleson demanded more playing time through his play. Still not very good, not good enough against left-handed pitching, and that's pretty common for left-handed hitters. Mm-hmm. Playing every day is problematic, but he's taken to the outfield. He's been a very good first baseman. You know, Brendan Donovan, the all-star, just his level of steadiness, the fielding ability at a couple spots. Again, you'd like to see more success against lefties, but he has held up as a guy who initially people doubted because of the lack of exit velocity. So right. Those are the guys at the top. Wilson Contreras, a little bit of a markdown because the start was so terrible. But, man, he has been a run producer. He's exactly what they need. Great transition to first base. Terrific job. He's been good in the middle of the season. He's been generally good in RBI situations. Really turned things around and really powered through a terrible start and didn't let it affect him. So, you know, those are the guys you look at who, you know, you give the highest marks to. And Mason Wynn, he's faded a bit. He's still, to me, a B versus an A. Great in the field and such. But, man, he is really offensively, as the grind took its toll, he's had to battle the back issue. Started the year tremendous on offense, his hitting, and his fielding is there. But, man, it's been tough for him heading into the break. Man, this last stretch, let's say last 6 weeks or so, it's been difficult for Mason. Still one of your cornerstones for sure, and he's just continuing. He'll just, to me, he's going to be an A player in his career, just handling the grind and getting through this year two of this.
What is he offensively for you, Jeff?
Well, I think we know him and his limitations. I just think because he's been fighting it now for so long, and then you add in the element where he was hoping to become more of a base stealer and add that element to his game, but that did not materialize. Again, he's dealing with the back issue and the grind of playing in a very tough fielding position
and getting on base.
Yeah. And, you know, so more walks, more steals. I think he's found his spot a little more down in the order because he's not an on base guy. But, you know, guy's a competitive hitter, just would like to see more, you know, after that, when he's hitting 270, you feel really good about where he's at. When that starts to fall off, where he's going through a stretch, hitting closer to the Mendoza line, now you want to see how he finishes the year. But those guys were like the top of the curve. You know, trying to, you know, Victor Scott, you know, a struggle, great start, saw the spin, became more of a problem. Obviously struggles against lefties like the rest of left-handed hitters. But brilliant fielder, you know, and you can play him as your nine guy because he's so brilliant in the field. He can steal bases. That's a huge plus. I think he's an improved player. Still got to learn to fight through this adjustment, but certainly he's on the high side of the scale, despite the fact that his, you know, like Wynn really saw his batting average fall off. Going down from there, you know, fans kind of turn on Newsbar because he got a lot of attention because of his personality and his funny name and all the media stuff. And he's a TV darling, but it is concerning to see his OPS lag down closer to 700 than 800. I'd like to see this guy as a 780 OPS guy who's a good glove. He went into a prolonged stretch. Obviously, couldn't hit at the top of the order anymore. Went into a long stretch where now he's fighting the back, the side pain. He's fighting the grind. Stays more or less healthy, but the grind takes its toll. He's got to prove he can do it for a full season. Not quite there. And then he ends back up on the IL again. So he ends up a little bit below the curve. You know, it pained me to, for a guy like Nolan Arenado, I gave him a D plus. And here's the thing, man, he's a hardcore guy, hardcore competitor, all out, still a plus fielder. But, you know, you look at the decline offensively and the fact he's just not been able to reverse the decline. And then judging for him, the salary, the total compensation. What it costs. Yeah, the Cardinals haven't had to pay the whole freight. Yeah, a lot of it's deferred. But it's still, he's a huge payroll guy, and he's offensively as a hitter, you know, replacement level or worse at times, especially when he gets in these ruts. So it's a tough case. I mean, he's a guy you literally can't give away. And that's a tough place for a guy who's a, you know, Hall of Fame, potential Hall of Fame candidate, longtime Gold Glover, tremendous competitor, wants to win, all those things. But at the plate, for a team that's dying for more pop, especially from the right side, man, and as a six hitter, he just hasn't done much looking at that. And I don't know, man, it's hard to do that knowing how hard this guy plays. But again, he's making a lot of money. And so that's for most of the guys on the team, that's not really a factor. But for him and Michaelis, another example, it is. You just have to weigh that as as a context point. So, you know, on balance, some really good things. And then going on another note, like Jordan Walker, don't want to give him an F yet, but colossal failure this year. Just unfortunate. You know, yeah, the wrist was a setback. The appendicitis was a setback. Got going for a little bit. Started well. What, the first handful of games, very good. But it's hard to watch because the kid puts the work in. He's a much improved fielder. The range plays, the arm plays. He's better at reading of the ball. Real progress in the outfield. Put the work in, but has not been able to find it. And now we're getting to the point where he's at an age. What do you think, Derek? I mean, I'm not going to write him off, but it's getting close to where guys are going to pass him, or they're going to have to go out and find a guy to pass him to fill that hole.
It's so interesting because it's not so much his age. It's like it's where he is in his career. You know, the Cardinals, he's been optioned back to the minors, right? These option years add up. All of a sudden, there's some inflexibility there. So, you know, he's essentially a big leaguer who has to stay in the big leagues if you're looking at trading him or if you're a team looking to trade for him. You know, he hasn't really manifested the production that validates the swing changes they've asked him to make. And, you know, he feels that, he knows that, he can read his baseball card, he can see the scoreboard, he can feel what isn't being produced there. And now it's not an isolated time. You see these guys go through swing changes and it struggles at times. You know, Alec Burleson went through, you know, a swing decision change essentially, and he struggled and he wondered and he had a few more strikeouts than he really likes, but the payoff was clear and the payoff is there. For Jordan Walker, it's been, what, 2 years of this? That's a hard slog. And you wonder what that has done for, you know, his confidence level, for his clarity, for his feel, for his just, you know, place with the Cardinals. And, you know, his age says do not get prospect fatigue. But his contract and this whole past few years, you would totally understand if Jordan had organization fatigue. Like, you would get it. And I don't know where that puts him. It's a really tricky spot. And even when he returns to the majors, you know, I see this very fascinating. I mean, he's putting in the work in Double-A. They don't want to option him to Double-A, right? Like, what kind of message does that send? But yet they've put him there on this rehab assignment because of the folks he can work with there. But you wouldn't option him there, and that's a decision they're going to have to make here shortly. And then if he does come back, then where does he play? You know, there's not really a clear spot for him unless they're willing to put somebody other than Victor Scott in center field to make it all work. And I just don't know. I mean, it's such a unfortunate and – for the club, I'm sure disappointing, and for Jordan Walker, I'm sure disappointing, and for all parties, frustrating, you know, place. I watch him play, and I keep thinking back to the spring training when he made the major league team, and just such excitement and enthusiasm around him and for who he was at that time. And then it was so soon after that they were like, well, who he is isn't what we think he can be, and why isn't he there yet? And it's like, gosh. Why fast forward? What was the problem with who he was at that time and that he might grow into something? I don't know. You can't undo the past, but that is definitely one that they're going to look back on and go, golly, what could have been? unless he emerges from this just a different guy. And I don't know. This is really tough. May I hit you with a trivia question or like a little statistical question here? Put you on the spot, Jeff. All right. We know who bats higher in the order, but who has the higher on base percentage of these two players who really let's agree they must be defined by their on base percentage and the lack of making outs? Mason Wynn or Victor Scott II?
Now, the way you've set that up makes me go and look at, say, hey, maybe Victor's got the better, better on base percentage because, and if that's the case, that is concerning. Although I'm a fan of Victor's willingness to keep working on the game as hard as he does, you know, which he does. I mean, this is a guy that carries himself, who works just like Mason, and who's had to make adjustments. A guy who was not a great hitter in college, who's become a regular at the big league level. Yeah. How many times has that happened? He was drafted on raw tools, and look at him. So, yeah. I think Victor is a good story. Could become a great story at some point if this trend continues. So he's, you know, love to see him bunt a little more effectively than he has here. But you know, gosh, the kid competes. He studies, and he likes looking at the old timers too. So that's
a plus. Mason Wynn has.
I think Wynn's just got to try to find that level of where he's at. Make sure he doesn't get caught up trying to be too much, go big too often. Mm-hmm. Try to stay within, you know, where he's at, and know that that'll come as he gets stronger and more mature. But to stay in it, a couple other guys I wanted to mention before I forget.
You want the answer though?
I would say it's Scott, right?
Wynn has a 317 on base percentage. Scott, 318.
Yeah, see, you set it up so I could answer it. But yeah, it's the fact that they're so close is pretty alarming, right? Because you'd consider Wynn to be a far advanced hitter, and because of the success he's had overall. So, all right, a couple other things. You know, we mentioned Walker. I thought Gorman made a nice comeback. He's more of the middle of the pack grade wise. It was awful at the beginning. He had to wait for his chance to come. He had a really good stretch where when he got regular at bats, he was able to deliver a good OPS. You know, it's been a little more lean lately, but he did have a good sustained run there when he got at bats, and he's made adjustments. He's worked, Lord knows he takes this very seriously, and he's working very hard on it. He's done a better job of with the high pitches, still has some trouble, still tends to pull that trigger, still gets caught chasing that. But I think he's made progress. He's gotten back to pretty close to where he was. Now, maybe that ceiling's not super high, but a guy that can slug, and if he can play, you know, some third base, some second base, and slug, particularly do damage against right-handers, you know, he can be a useful player. As we've seen, he's delivered some big blows. So I think he's gotten back closer to where he was, where Jordan obviously didn't, more of a middle-of-the-pack guy. Big thumb up for his very limited role. You have to give Yoel Pozo that. Big hits. A lot of energy, tough role, but he comes up. He was never going to draw a walk, doesn't care about that. He would come up there to hit. And his role, exactly what you need. And he's been an asset. The flip side of that for me, Páez is a big plus behind the plate. He suffered like 9 million injuries back there on foul balls, getting clobbered in the head with the bat, getting smashed in the face mask. Lord knows many below the belt blows. He's taken a beating back there. He does a pretty good job as a fielder, a great job with the pitchers. He's got to hit more. Derek's got to hit more. He's really been in a tough stretch there. This team's got catchers on the rise with Crooks and Bernal, and so I don't know, man. He's got to hit more, and that's reflected. But, boy, what a plus behind the plate. Could be a big league catcher for a long time as an everyday catcher. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think he's got enough of a hit tool that he could do it, but it's all dependent on what the Cardinals get elsewhere. I mean, you look at this lineup right now, and they have, you could argue, four defense first players, right, that are clearly contributing more defensively than they are offensively, and that's 4/9 of the lineup. And then you have a DH who's supposed to be a catcher, who's a really good above average hitter, significantly above average impact, above average hitter at catcher, as he has a DH. You know, and then the outfield as a whole is not producing. So the kind of offense that you, the kind of robust offense you want from the outfield. So I think, you know, they're hit collectors as a team. That means they play the probabilities, and when they get a bunch of hits in a row or timely hits, they win. But they're not doing the damage, the offense, the big slugging pop that is necessary in today's game. They're very much a probability team, both on the offense and on pitching. And I think when you look at that and you add in the fact that you, like I said, arguably have four guys in the lineup who are producing or providing more defensively, it's just harder and harder for the probabilities to line up, and therefore it becomes harder and harder to carry a guy who is defense first at multiple positions. You could do it. They did it for a while at catcher. They've done it before at shortstop. They've done it before at center field. But doing it at all three spots at the same time is very difficult.
Yeah, and I'll give you know, Pedro a year ago was a good situational hitter. More recently, that's been more difficult for him in terms of those RBI situations, you know, just whether it's advancing a runner, mm-hmm. Getting a ground ball through, getting a fly ball, whatever. He had a lot of success last year. He was a great success story a year ago, the way he moved himself into that position and made the most of it. And the way he works with the team is all so positive. So I see him having a role with the team. It's just a question of what do they do with the other guys on the climb? How much progress can Ivan make? What do you realistically expect from Crooks, who's been good but not great offensively in Triple A? You got a guy Double A who's got all the tools in the world with switch hitting and, you know, just, you know, at a young age, there seems to be so much more growth there. Do you trade one of those two prospects in order in a baseball trade to try to fill a pitching need? Where do you go with that? So what do you do with Ivan? What realistically, well, how much more can you do with him? Mm-hmm. But you know he's going to be in your lineup as a hitter. But so yeah, these are some. As we talk about going back to the trade deadline, these are the discussions that the pluses and minuses of the guys we just talked about are kind of converging as they try to figure out, okay, what do we do? How do we set this up for next year?
All right, let's close here. I want to ask Professor Jeff Gordon about the team as a whole and maybe the lens you use then to look at the individuals. Jeff, did you grade on a curve? And if so, what curve did you use? Did you use the Cardinals' reset transition curve, or did you consider their history and their historic brand curve? Did you grade them against who they said they'd be? Did you grade them against who they should be?
Yeah, I try to be realistic with the context of that. For instance, it would be easy just to flunk ownership because this team is not what it used to be. But for this year, they had to make decisions. They had to change course. The ownership had to change course, and it did. Would have done it differently, but I did the context of last year was like, okay, you failed based on the last couple of years. It's been a failure here because you just haven't met your standard. So you made decisions. So I based it on the context of the challenge that this team faced. Where are you? What realistically can you do at this point, right? So I judge Ollie on the challenge he was given, which is, you know, do the best you can, develop players, try to stay competitive. Let's see what happens. All right, you made the most of that. Mo, you know, well, look, you have less payroll. You tried to trade Aaron out to get something for him. You couldn't. Didn't work out. Wasn't your fault. You're stuck. What are the expectations realistically within what you can do? And for the players, a lot of it is, okay, your expectations, what are realistic expectations for this player? Do they exceed, meet, or fail? And then you factor into if it's a highly paid veteran player, you can't ignore that context. You know, if you're taking up a big piece of the remainder of the payroll that's been reduced and you're not performing at a high level, then there's that context. You're being judged against your pay as well as, you know, maybe past performance because that's what you're being paid for. So really it's a long answer to what you wanted. A short answer was it just depends on each scenario. I was trying to do context with everybody. Pozo gets an A because what did you expect the guy coming in from the minors to do? Well, he exceeded it. In some ways, you know, could we be harsh on Scott for not hitting for a higher average? Not really. He is who he is. He's trying to get to a certain place. Can we be disappointed in Lars Nootbaar for not becoming the player over a whole season that he was for a partial season? I think that's fair because it was an important year in his career. The context of Lars Nootbaar at his point in his life, at his point in his career, this was a big year. It's not been a great year. So it really just depends on each person and in each part of the thing we're looking at.
You think you're going to go pass fail for the next semester here? They get in, they don't get in, pass fail.
Yeah, gosh, you know, if they miss the playoffs and play competitively, I'm not going to hold it against the field staff. If they stay the course, they take their shot, they come up short, unless there are some weird decisions made by the field staff. Mm-hmm. I just don't think a team that's got one above average starting pitcher can be reasonably expected to make the playoffs. At the end of the day, they're all healthy, great. They haven't missed time. They haven't had to pull guys off the pile to stick them in there. Fine. But, you know, I don't want to sound like Ollie here, but, you know, what do you think is going to happen when you don't have strikeout guys? When the probability that some days you're going to have a bad day when you don't strike people out, and that's kind of where they are. So in terms of the rest of the year, we'll see. I mean, if management can make some really big trades and work for the future and it tanks the season, but they can justify it because we're excited about the return, you know, we'll see. So it's not there's so many different ways to look at this team because we don't know where it's going to be or why or what is the best course because it's kind of like, So, yeah, we're waiting and seeing like everyone else.
That is Professor Jeff Gordon, who got his PhD in midseason and postseason grades at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He's been doing it for years. He did it again at stltoday.com. You can find all of those grades and the explanations. That's also where you can find all of his work, his columns, his videos with fellow columnist Lynn Worthy, and, of course, Tip Sheet, the daily rundown of the sports world from a St. Louis perspective. You can find all the Constant Cardinals coverage, including all the coverage from the All-Star Game in Atlanta at stltoday.com and in the pages of the Post-Dispatch. I've got a midseason report coming in Friday's St. Louis Post-Dispatch and online at stltoday.com. And then on Sunday, Jeff, I'm going to get a chance to write the story that I spent a lot of time talking to All-Stars about. And I'm excited about it because it is where that All-Star Game and the Cardinals draft meet and how far the Cardinals have fallen behind their peers and how the draft shows their attempt to try to catch up. Got a chance to talk with Clayton Kershaw about it, Josh Hader about it. Josh Hader, a product of the Milwaukee Brewers' great development pitching development system, who is kind of one of the teams that pushed ahead and continues to remain ahead of the Cardinals. So had a good time kind of trying to track down that story and see if I could put it together. And now it is my challenge to make it readable for Sunday's paper. So hopefully I pull that off. I had good talks with Brent Rooker, a bunch of different folks about it, about this topic, and we'll see if I can pull it off. You can find the best podcast in baseball wherever you get your podcast. Rate, review, subscribe. You know the drill. It'd be really nice to hear some reviews there on iTunes if you have a chance, just about how this season is unfolding with the best podcast in baseball. And you know what? Give us your grades, right, Jeff? You're busy giving out grades. Let's see some grades. You know, if you're hearing this, if you listen this far, drop some grades into the reviews or go ahead and reply on social media to me with some grades of the podcast. Let's see what people are saying and let's see where we can improve. The best podcast in baseball is brought to you weekly by Closets by Design of St. Louis. For Jeff Gordon, I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould. Off we go to the trade deadline. I'm headed to Colorado, Jeff, for my, the Colorado Rockies series there. And it happens that it coincides with my birthday. So nice of Major League Baseball to give me a chance to be close to where I grew up for my birthday.
Well, enjoy it. I was just in Colorado for a week, and I missed the mountains already. And say hello to the mountains. Tell them I miss it.
I will. I definitely feel that, and I definitely will. I'm looking forward to it. It'll be nice to breathe in the thin air a little bit after the thick air that you guys welcomed me back from Atlanta with. So thank you very much.
Well, enjoy, man. Enjoy.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand. through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.